Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week we look at the upcoming US election whilst the country grapples with the coronavirus, civil unrest and a toppling stock market. Republican Trump is pushing on, promising more stimulus, election eve vaccines and firing off shots at the US postal system in an attempt to stymie postal voting. Past Vice President Sleepy Joe Biden is on the Democratic ticket, promising to right the wrongs on healthcare, expand green investment, and lift the minimum wage whilst raising taxes on the wealthy. With the polls favouring Biden throughout this pandemic-ridden 2020 election cycle, the question remains, can Trump reenact his 2016 performance and pull off another surprise victory at the ballot box, and thus avoid being the first president to not serve a second term since George Bush Sr.? Or will Biden be able to maintain his lead and restore some order to the United States political system and perhaps the markets? Here to run through our thoughts and discuss how they may be incorporated in our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And also on the line, we have our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello, David.
G'day, Tim.
Fantastic. Good to have you on, fellas. And just a quick reminder before we get started to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live now, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar, and we can answer those along the way. So the agenda today, we're going to kick off by looking at the polls. We'll then run through the platforms for the two major parties. We'll be looking at some black swans and outcomes, peeling across to the markets, and then finishing up as we do on the investment outlook and how we incorporate these themes every day here at Nucleus Wealth and in the MB Fund. So on that note, we'll jump into the polls. David, Biden ahead.
Well, he's been ahead consistently for... well, at least the duration of our chart. I think it's a couple of years. Gotten a very big boost during COVID-19 pandemic, etc. And that polling gap has been very consistent for some time, you know, kind of 6 or 8 points. You can take or leave the polls, of course. We saw smaller but similarly consistent leads in the 2016 election for Hillary Clinton, which of course didn't play out at all as expected in the election proper. But you would hope, and I don't have evidence for this, but you would hope that the pollsters have adjusted their methodologies appropriately since, and so that these polls would be somewhat more reliable. But there is a risk that we'll see a rerun, but the polls, for what it's worth, are still firmly in the Biden camp. That's also the case in the battleground states, the swing states that are going to matter, where the gap is smaller but is still pretty consistent, around 4 points. Obviously, these polls swing around, with their margins of error and the different practitioners and methodologies and what have you, and so you'll see different readings on that gap, but these charts I've got up here, these are aggregated charts from Real Clear, and so they should capture all of those variables reasonably consistently. Biden's on track for a reasonable win, and that is also reflected in a decent gap in betting markets, which have had a much wilder ride than the polls themselves. With huge kind of lead for Biden until recently, when the COVID-19 numbers started to fall away, and perhaps also Trump, gained a little bit of his mojo back with his attacks on China and attacks on the Black Lives Matter movement, and that kind of segueing into a law and order issue, or recouched as a law and order issue as various protests have merged, or don't want to be overly sensitive to this, but either protests or riots, depending on which side of the aisle you sit. anyway, that has segued into a law and order issue that may give Trump some extra traction. So,
but I just want to highlight as well, Dave. Look, I mean, because one of the things I find interesting is this: is that the point you're saying about, there's a lot of people who go, well, yeah, the pollsters, they've got it wrong once before, and so therefore they'll never ever get it right ever again. So whatever they say, it'll be the opposite. Is sort of that part about going, well, yeah, look, you know, they obviously did make some mistakes, to give them some credit as well, you know, most of the two-way votes, they actually got Hillary's votes pretty close to right in terms of the way the voting was going, and they were behind probably 2 or 3% in terms of Donald's votes. And keep in mind that, you know, Hillary did win by 2% in terms of the popular vote. Like, it wasn't like a small gap. So you know, if you looked at this one and you said, okay, well, you could on this chart you could have what have we got? We've got Biden at 50%. He could I guess what I'm thinking is if he could win the popular vote by 2% and still lose the election, 2 or even 3% and still lose the election. And so, you know, you don't actually need, it needs to go back to the individual states and the individual sections about which states are likely to fall or rise. And sort of taking it to, you know, back to that part about saying the polls said Hillary would win and she didn't, therefore the polls are wrong. Sort of, I think, ignores some of those bigger issues about the distribution of where it's coming from.
And I'll just add, from what qualitative stuff I've read, on where the movements are demographically, it seems elderly white centrists have shifted away from Trump, which you could put down to any number of reasons, but certainly the virus presents itself as a prime candidate, and Biden has lost a little bit of minority support, apparently. Which may surprise some, but there you have it. I think, for instance, his strong China stance has actually played very well in, like, the Asian American community, things like that. Okay, so moving on then. So, you know, we've got the Dems as favourites, basically, pretty firm favourites based on the polling. So segue that into the two platforms. And Biden, basically, you know, could be couched as, it's not quite an empty chair platform. He's got some pretty decent economic reforms, but certainly smallish target, I guess you would call it. And to that extent, he's trying to make it a sort of referendum on Trump. and his platform is very much about, you know, reconciliation and unification. Bringing the country back together, which, you know, clearly is a dig at Trump's divisive politics, but as well, it you know, neatly addresses some of the civil strife that we've seen in the last year or so, as an angry population has expressed itself through, you know, various racial protests and divisions. You know, what we'll see with Biden is, you know, more virus science, which you would think it would appeal to a fairly broad cross-section of people, especially centrists. He has probably his most innovative area is tax reforms, which are to wind back some of Trump's corporate tax cut and to boost taxes on the wealthy, you know, especially around things like capital gains, etc., and yoke that with minimum wage increases. So these are some good, we think very good long-term reforms to help address US inequality and therefore good for growth insofar as they'll boost domestic demand. And, you know, that's useful in all sorts of number of ways, everything from rising wages to increased investment. To offset rising wages and therefore driving higher productivity and higher incomes, et cetera, et cetera. And so that would actually be a bullish outcome for the US, though, you know, initially it might shock the stock market because it's a bit of a regime change, especially with the higher corporate taxes. Much more constructive on the green economy, obviously, both at home and abroad. That would pose a bit of a problem here, I suspect. But in the US, how that will play in the election, I really can't say. Certainly, it'll play well to the Democrats' base. Healthcare, similar. Biden's committed to the Obama reforms. And again, good for the Democratic base, good for, I would have thought, centrist politics. And much more constructive internationally. Certainly still quite firm with China, but less tariffs and much more of a multilateral approach. So again, you would think for centrist pro-American policy followers, it's probably strong enough on China. And then BLM, Black Lives Matter, I mean, he hasn't really put out that much policy I've seen on what he would actually do, but certainly his rhetoric is much more conciliatory than is Trump's. And at the end of the day, you would think that law and order is basically a bipartisan issue, and it would come down to negotiating what the outcomes are going to for BLM will need to be.
And actually, Biden does actually he polls better on who's going to who would be better at managing the law and order side of it. So in terms of being, when people actually get asked the question is who do you trust in charge of it? He does poll better.
So it is much more of a centrist platform than if we flip over to Trump, where it's much more about base politics. Divisiveness and really trying to peel away some traditional components of the Democratic base that are generally associated with working classes. So it's obviously smash China, and would it be actually be any worse or any more so than what we've already seen in the last cycle? Hard to know, but certainly the rhetoric will suggest it is, and he's definitely doing a very good job of bashing up various Chinese assets in the US to make that point. I would just think his virus outlook is almost pure voodoo. Any number of examples of that, no need to go into it. And I just can't see how the virus can play well for Trump at all. Like as Winston Churchill once said, the US always does the right thing when it's exhausted all other possibilities. And the right thing is clearly to treat the virus with science. I mean, you can debate what that means, but it's certainly not disinfectant into the veins. And so, you know, with 200,000 deaths, which is, you know, half as many Americans that died in the Second World War, just seems catastrophic for the virus, the virus vis-a-vis Trump. Particularly with centrists and elderly centrists, you know, who are obviously on the receiving end of the worst implications of that. He's also quite committed to infrastructure, which will appeal, but questionable whether he can actually deliver it. The Democrats have plans to fund infrastructure via various taxes, whereas Trump does not. But there's some chance of that. He's also mooted some small tax cuts around the margins, again, for businesses. Obviously much harder on borders, much harder on American first diplomacy, and much harder on BLM and law and order. They're just much less centrist. It's a much less centrist platform, and is unlikely to appeal, obviously, to the centrists who are, you know, somewhat shocked and awed by, firstly, the Trump regime, and secondly, the virus. So I would just put those two platforms down as probably the Dems being more apposite to the times.
And I guess in terms of investment perspectives though on those two platforms. I mean, the biggest one comes out is the Biden tax raising taxes.
Yep.
So that's and the minimum wage increases. It's that interesting part about, you know, you need to save. At times, capitalism needs to be saved from itself, but the immediate impact of minimum wage increases is that companies are going to make a smaller share of the, they're going to take a smaller share of the national pie than what they have been in the recent times. And while we think that's actually a good thing for your 5 or your 10 year outlook, it's pretty hard to come up with a scenario where that's good in the 1 or 2 year outlook on earnings.
Yeah, well, I guess you know, in terms of the election as well, it's redistribution versus trickle down economics. You know, is the US ready for some more redistribution politics? I mean, the rise of Bernie suggests it might be. And certainly, you know, plenty of anger over inequality. I guess the question is, does Trump's angry, you know, diversion of that anger capture those disaffected workers, or can a more rational approach win them back to the Dems?
Yeah, and I guess I'm trying to step outside and say, look, we'll speculate that at different times, but I just want to, I guess, nail down those investment sides in terms of saying, okay, regardless of which argument wins the emotional argument, in terms of the investment argument, in the short term, it looks as if Biden's would make, you know, at least sort of 10-15%. You could probably slice off some of the earnings rate of the market in terms of additional taxes and higher margins and things like that. With the benefit that you've actually got better growth in the long term, whereas Trump's a bit more extended pretend. So yes, earnings probably look good for another year or two and under Trump if he gets up, but you've got to keep worrying about that we're stuck in the same position where we are, where just that low growth grind under Trump is more likely. Whereas I guess Biden, it's more likely to be a down at the start, and then, well, within 4 years, I suppose you'd probably be getting some recovery on that.
I think much quicker than that.
I guess what I'm saying is, if you're going to give up, no, but if you're going to give up 10% of your earnings, 10-15% of your earnings in tax cuts, then you'd be lucky to get that back. As a company, you'd be lucky to get that back by the end of 4 years. Would you say?
No, I reckon two. I mean, don't forget, you know, you'll get much better top-line growth. Yes, you'll get a margin squeeze, but you'll be selling more stuff. And it won't take long for firms to start investing into those higher wages, you know, with various, you know, automations. And so productivity will lift as well. So I think, you would definitely see an initial hit, no doubt. But I think within 2 years, you start to see some pretty good turnaround. And certainly within four, I would expect the economy to be much better than it would alternatively.
The counterfactuals is different.
Yes.
I guess what I'm saying is there's a difference between saying under the existing one, if you're just going to grind and it just keeps grinding lower, then you absolutely do definitely much better as an investor from the Biden side over a longer term. But the reality is markets don't price off that long earnings anyway. They generally look at the next year, maybe the next 2 years in some cases.
Yeah. But, I completely agree. There's an initial hit, no doubt. So shorter term is definitely more bearish for stocks. And I guess therefore probably more bullish for credit, although not necessarily if you think that those wage rises will flow through to increased wage inflation, but I'm not sure that you could draw that conclusion anyway.
Yeah. I mean, and then there's also this question about timing in terms of saying, well, you know, there's ideally for, I guess, for him is you're getting, well, you don't want to be knocking people over at the bottom of the cycle. You don't want to be making the crash worse in terms of the crash in earnings that we're seeing from companies. And we're going to start seeing more bankruptcies. Is you know, that's your other issue is if it's all sort of full on day one, right, cop this, everyone gets a big tax cuts, tax hikes, plus all these immediate hikes in earnings, just as companies are deciding whether they'll make it or not through the cycle, or whether they need to declare bankruptcy, you might actually end up making that part even a bit lower, that whole bankruptcy part. Whereas if it's more time to sort of be a bit more gradual or a bit more as the economy's starting to recover, you get to see it, then I think there's, you know,
sure,
that's another factor that'll factor into how the investment outlook takes.
Well, that obviously depends as well on the election outcome, which we'll come back to, because we're talking really in terms of a Dems clean sweep here, or for that matter, you know, a status quo under Trump, and there are other possible outcomes.
Okay. Yes.
So next page, you know, with that kind of setup behind us, we want to look at possible kind of black swans that are going to hit this, and some of them are already here. One of them is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which is not a huge deal in and of itself, and that is the U.S. Supreme Court judge, progressive judge, who died recently, and so has complicated politics a great deal, is the main implication, because they need to elect a new Supreme Court justice, and that's just a huge kind of distraction for Congress, as the second of our black swans here, which is stalled fiscal support during the virus. It's complicated those negotiations a great deal. We already had stalled negotiations on the CARES program, with the Dems demanding much more than the Republicans wanted to give, which is a really odd position for the Republicans to get themselves into, given, you know, they're the ones who are in government are going to get blamed. But anyway, that's how the chips fell. And so the Ginsburg negotiations, or post-Ginsburg negotiations, have complicated all of that a great deal. You know, the likelihood is that the Republicans will get another nomination up prior to the election, or just prior and after, depending on how they think that it might influence the way the turnout and getting Republicans out to vote. And so they'll have a 6-3 kind of conservative majority in the Supreme Court, if there is any need for it to intervene in the election result. We don't necessarily see that as material, though, because you have to assume that the justices are influenced by politics, and mostly they're kind of pretty well screened before they get to this level anyway. There's not many kind of political nutters that can get through to this stage, and so that's not a hugely concerning kind of risk. But the big risk is that simply that the Ginsburg replacement issue has really complicated negotiations over fiscal policy. So it doesn't look like we're going to get a new fiscal package before the election, and that certainly has amplified election volatility for the stock market, because, you know, you have already pretty clear evidence that falling fiscal support for households are starting to impact spending, and, you know, there's no more coming now until we can clear the decks, until January, at least, probably. And so that's quite an economic blow. And then that has, you know, monetary implications, and you might call this a black swan or some kind of, you know, unexpected outcome. If fiscal is stalled and the stock market is really struggling with the election possibilities, both political and economic, then, you know, it sets up the possibility of, you know, with such an inflated stock market, does the stock market need to crash to prevent itself from crashing? By that, I mean it is thoroughly supported by very loose monetary policy and fiscal policy. And so does it need to remind policymakers that without those supports, it will fall? And so it has to fall to stop itself from falling. And that brings you kind of full circle back to the Federal Reserve. And you have to ask, you know, what if markets really do start to get a bit unruly? And I think in this case, the base case is still further falls. You know, when does the Fed step in? What kind of influence might that have on the election result? Difficult to know. You know, where is the Fed put? How far below? And what would it do? You know, it's. I don't think it's imminent. Powell was in Congress last night demanding more fiscal and trying to, you know, unblock the logjam, but that isn't going to happen, it looks like. So, you know, the buck's going to stop with him sooner rather than later if markets keep falling. So there's another, you know, sort of double black swan there in that stalled fiscal may lead to further monetary intervention if markets, you know, get unstable.
Yeah. And David and I, we've spoken about the irony is that, you know, markets will need to crash a bit in order to get either politicians or the Fed going, so that'll prevent markets from crashing further.
Yes. Other possible black swans, well, obviously, you know, Trump is really giving China an absolute thrashing at the moment. It's pretty out of the box, some of the stuff he's doing, essentially, you know, nationalizing Chinese assets, more or less, for the US private sector. And that's pretty intense stuff with WeChat, TikTok, et cetera. There's no reason for him to stop that. He might just continue on. It's pretty good politics for his base, and it makes it, you know, by definition, I think makes the Biden camp look certainly less China hawkish, if that, you know, in people's minds concludes China weakness. You know, that's probably Trump's goal. So how intense does he get? And, you know, how long does China just cop it? At the moment, they've been very, very soft in response. Like when you consider the kind of response we got out of the push for COVID-19 transparency, or during the trade war prior to that, China was much stronger in its responses than to Trump's recent stuff. The obvious thing it could do is start to pull back from the trade deal, but they're not doing that. So, you know, what China doesn't want to have a conflict with Trump prior to the election, it seems. Why do they want a democratic regime? I can't answer these questions. I don't know. But I mean, there's obviously a danger that either Trump goes so far with his China bashing that he either upsets the markets, or he just simply pushes Beijing too far and there's a backlash. There is daily, you know, kind of saber rattling going on in the Taiwan Straits, all sorts of stuff happening there, which no need to go into. I don't think we reach a point here where we get a tail wagging the dog conflict with China, a small scale war or something of that nature. Seems unlikely, quite unlikely, but perhaps by accident, who knows? But certainly,
and it's probably worth saying as well. China would seem to have a preference for not Trump.
Yes, well, yes.
Not to say it'll necessarily be better for them, but you would think that they would recognize that, you know, if they inflame U.S. nationalism, that's probably going to end up with more votes for China for Trump than if they don't.
Yeah, I mean it's really debatable which would be better for China. I mean Trump's certainly done a marvelous job in unmasking the Communist Party, I think, and changing, you know, and really destroying its soft power push, you know, into imperialism, economic imperialism, and that's been a huge long-term blow, no doubt about it. But with that gone, you know, is China better served by, you know, a democratic regime that seeks to multilateralize that conflict without walking away from it, or by a Trump who maintains unilateralism and alienates allies? You know, if you accept as the base case that China decoupling or Cold War, whatever you want to call it, is now inevitable, then arguably you're better off with Trump if you're China. Yep. So anyway, who knows what calculus they've made, but there certainly is some kind of risk here of some sort of China black swan. Antifa and BLM, again, who could say? I mean, there are ongoing riots, ongoing protests, and conflict. The law and order issue, could it get inflamed? Could Trump, you know, invade one of his own cities in crackdowns? Who knows? It's just, again, it's one of those civil strife issues that's clearly bubbling away in the background that we need to be aware of. Very difficult to predict. Just raises the temperature of politics again. And so something we need to watch. And so swinging across to the election outcomes.
Dave, just before we do that, we've had a question pop in as well.
Sure.
We might as well tackle now. And anybody else who's thinking of popping in questions, of course, head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar in the chat box there. Question here, do you think the average US voter is going to be thinking in such a long-term manner? People seem to be very angry about the now, but the later is largely ignored.
Yeah. Can't answer that.
Well, I think they're absolutely right. I guess what we're talking about is we're talking about what we think the outcomes are from an investment sense from these taking a longer term view, whereas you're absolutely right that I think the average voter in any country will vote with you know, the swinging voter will vote with what, you know, the latest thing that excites them. And so you know, something that rose nationalist, you know, like going to war with China, a small scale war with China, is going to rise nationalistic impulses in US that are probably going to benefit Trump, but it's not it's obviously not a good thing for either country in the longer term. So
I mean, I guess having the black swan section is really about that insofar as, you know, times are tempestuous. Yes. So there's all sorts of short-term risks where that anger could be corralled or misappropriated by an unscrupulous populist. So, it's definitely possible that anger could cause a boil over.
Very good. Okay, we'll jump across to outcomes.
So, I mean, my base case is still that the Dems win, and probably comfortably. At the end of the day, this really comes down to the virus for me and what I said before, and that is, I think when the rubber finally hits the road, the Americans are rational enough to do the right thing, having exhausted all other options. And so I just think killing 200,000 of your countrymen is a bridge too far. So, you know, that's what the polls say, and I think they've probably been corrected enough to predict the outcome at this stage, barring, you know, Trump really being able to swing some new scandal. So, that being said, I might just swing down to the bottom one. The number four rather than number two, the Dems might win and might even get a clean sweep, but it might not happen straight away. And I think that this is one of the outcomes that's really bugging markets. You know, we've seen Trump just today and pretty consistently trolling the election big time, especially around postal votes. He's obviously setting up to dispute the outcome. it's entirely possible that he wins on the night and then loses the election weeks later owing to postal votes, which he is already, you know, firing bazookas at daily to ensure that they have no credibility, in which case, you know, we'd be into all sorts of constitutional crisis if we got that far. You know, the other option, of course, is Dems within the White House, but not the Congress, and that might be one of the better case outcomes.
Not the Senate, you mean?
The Senate. And, you know, markets tend to like policy paralysis for the reason, you know, obviously that people can't stuff things up. but that said, if the election's that close, it kind of it's rinse and repeat back to number four, you know, which is anything other than a really decisive Democratic victory, you know, might fall victim to Trump and his populism. I mean, today he was asked directly, will you ensure a peaceful transition of power? And he basically said no. He won't.
Yes.
In fact, he said if you don't have the ballots, you won't need the transition. So I mean, they're pretty extraordinary statements, even for a known troll.
Yeah. You know, well, and also suggesting that people should test out by voting in person and voting by mail.
Yeah. Vote for me twice. Yeah. So I know there's some pretty scary outcomes. Probably these are nervous giggles you can hear from me. I don't, you know, the idea that the U.S. constitutional in some way breaks owing to this would be a terrible outcome for the world. Hopefully we don't get there, but in terms of markets, you know, if you end up having to go through a lengthy period of uncertainty trying to figure out who's running the country, then I believe by January 3, a whole bunch of the Senate lose their seats, and that includes Nancy Pelosi. And then Jan 20, Trump would be out of a job. You know, if it's still in the Supreme Court or still being trying to figure it out, it then reverts back to the Senate leader, but Pelosi will be gone. So,
Pelosi's the House, so.
Oh, sorry, is it? House leader, is she?
House leader, yeah.
Right, sorry, I'm getting these things confused. But so the Speaker actually does inherit the presidency if there's a paralysis, but Nancy Pelosi won't be in power either. And so there's all sorts of new complications is the point I'm making. So there's potential for real flux and chaos in Washington around it. And obviously that's not good for markets. And the longer it goes, the more vicious it's going to become and the more reliant markets will become on the Federal Reserve. Which brings us to markets. And this is no longer conjecture. We've got a chart in here showing the VIX term structure, that's the volatility term structure, and it's clearly indicating that around the election there's a serious volatility risk. And we're already starting to see that priced into stocks. We're seeing the Australian dollar get belted, which we, you know, you would expect to continue. The 2020 the second half, well, the last sort of 6 months, smash of the US dollar has suddenly disappeared, and what was a seriously unbalanced market that was betting against the US dollar has now reversed upwards spectacularly. And
actually, let's just talk about the irony of that as well, David, that this is the same thing that happened in the financial crisis. Financial crisis centered on the US. Most of the pain happening in the US, but the US dollar rallied significantly.
That's right. I mean, as we've discussed many, many times, the US dollar is still, you know, the number one kind of safe haven trade when you get global instability, but ironically, especially US instability, which of course is usually global anyway by implication. And the US dollar is one of the reasons for that. You know, as we get a liquid cycle business cycle. US dollars flow out of the US into emerging markets and other jurisdictions looking for higher return, and so the US dollar falls. But the moment we get trouble, then they flow back to the center, and the US dollar starts to rise, and that virtuous cycle reverses and actually makes the US growth problem everybody's growth problem, because they all run out of dollars, their interest rates start to rise, commodity prices fall, and the whole reflation trade reverses. And so that's what we're looking at right now. It's still in its early, in its infancy, but we have, we've got 6 weeks to the election, and then, of course, some unknown period of uncertainty beyond the election. So there's plenty of time here for this to really get moving. And I'm seeing all sorts of early warning indicators in markets that are suggesting it may well continue as well. You know, you have this fundamental driver to put real meat on its bones. So, you know, that you can kind of follow the implications of that through for Australia, falling stocks, falling Aussie, falling commodities, and although China would be fine, and iron ore, I think, would probably be able to sort of throw this off going into the end of the year, it will be also, these days, iron ore is sensitive to the US dollar more than it used to be, and so I would expect it to get pretty hard too. And so you'll have quite a shock coming out of this this whole election kerfuffle. And so if that's big enough, which it may well be, you know, 2021, if you can look through this politics that hopefully would resolve itself constitutionally rather than through various forms of strife, if it comes, of course, we might just get a clean result, then, you know, next year we're a long way from defeating the virus, but we're certainly much better situated than we were coming into this year, with various methods, means and policies capping the virus these days, and allowing a slow grind higher in economic activity. And the next wave of that is vaccines and vaccine-flation. So 2021 could shape as a decent rebound in global terms. And so this would pose a pretty decent buying opportunity if we see value appear in markets owing to these various political shocks. That's my hope, in fact, for what happens, given markets are just so grotesquely overvalued at the moment, it's difficult to buy anything at all. So we've got a couple more charts there that are really just showing you that the volatility is really starting to get priced. That more or less wraps it up. I might just flip over to you, Damo, to give a wrap on what we're doing and the investment outlook.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think the obviously David's spoken through a number of different scenarios here, and we're headed into what could be quite different depending upon how the votes go, but it seems pretty clear we're headed into a period of volatility before that. I guess we're taking the view that your best case over the next little while is sideways in markets, and the worst case is in stock markets, and the worst case is considerably down. We think bonds are going to have to still give you some value in those scenarios. We saw during the week, a prominent economist came out in Australia suggesting that bonds still needed to go lower. We had the RBA talking about potentially maybe thinking about other things that it might need to do once it's decided that the little that it's done so far isn't enough. We had a former prime minister out last night, haranguing the Reserve Bank of Australia to do more. Reverse bank, as they called it. Yes, so. It's the point that Phil Lowe has been there for a number of years now, and I don't think he's ever met his inflation target, has he, Dave?
He did one quarter.
One quarter, right? There you go.
In 4 years.
In 4 years. Yeah. So And he, I think he does get paid $1 million a year to do it. So that, you know, that you think there'll be a few calls for somebody who can try and do more. But having said that, I won't go too much into the whole RBA bit. But I think that the issue for us is that we still think there's a case for bonds, and that so we're not through this yet. And that, you know, the next little while is going to be the volatility is going to mean that, you know, holding either international stocks and or bonds is going to give you a better outlook than trying to hold all these stocks through it.
We did shorten our duration though, because of the sort of risk reward in these short term issues versus the coming vaccine wave, which may cause steepening in the curve. Mm.
Yeah, the question is, and then the big question on that side is whether you do start getting governments really spending some money, and at that stage, the long end, you know, you'll start to see that in the long end. So we're a little bit more cautious at the long end. That's right. In terms of the, it is still this whole thought though. We are in this very low return environment. We still have valuations at extreme highs, we need to expect volatility. Once you get expensive markets, you don't need very big movements in some of the underlying fundamentals to actually see markets move quite considerably. So, we're certainly expecting to be a lot more active than we have over the last few years, over the next little while. And, it's about trying to thread that needle in terms of picking up the switch between these. And as we see particular assets get hit, is just back into cash and then onto the next opportunity is sort of where we're looking. So and the other thing I want to highlight is that we basically had the fastest fall ever and then the fastest rise ever. I do think there's a markets are moving at a much faster pace than they have in the past, and so for retail investors who are going to take a long time potentially to get comfortable with regime changes, they need to sort of keep that in mind that they're probably going to need to move a little bit faster than what they have in the past and be prepared to be a bit more tactical in terms of the switches in order to just get any returns out of these markets, because it'll be very easy to sort of, you know, dump your money into cash and then sort of be sitting there a couple of years later going, well, the economy did recover, or the economy did reach a low point, but markets ran up way ahead of it.
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Damien. Quick question for me, actually. In our larger tactical options that we've got, we've got the direct international access to between 10 and 15 markets, I think, from memory. Are there countries and sectors, obviously, given the fact that, you know, every country is sort of running its own race against COVID at the moment, that's sort of on the front of the shopping list, so to speak? Are we looking at it that way, or are we sort of just taking a more broad approach from a tactical piece?
Look, I think most of the world seems to be in the same basket for a lot of the coronavirus. I think there's certainly, you know, you can say that some are worse than others, but not considerably so, except maybe somewhere like a China, or if you look at Australia, New Zealand. Been pretty successful in terms of stamping out the virus, but the economies in those certainly aren't. None of those have improved particularly, we're not looking. So I guess economically speaking, we don't see a huge difference between the different countries. What we do see though between sectors is definitely said some big differences. And so where we're seeing the most volatility is somewhere where we really don't want to play, which is in the recovery stocks in terms of, say travel. That's where you see quite a lot of volatility within that. So that's one area where we're avoiding, just because we don't think that's, we think it's far too early to call the end on that. And so while it's, if you do get this miraculous recovery, those stocks would be very, very cheap, but they're not cheap if you're expecting, you know, this to be extended, and that's what we're thinking. Some of the other sectors, though, it's hard to try and find the ones where, again, it's an interesting bit about the clear winners are very expensive at the moment. So from coronavirus. And I guess companies that either benefited in their business model or their business model was unaffected. And so it's really playing around the edges of those where we're looking for value. And it, we do find it tends to be it does tend to be some European companies in some of the fringe markets. But generally speaking, a lot of the companies we're picking up do tend to have some more broader exposure, I guess, globally than so they happen to be listed in say a European market somewhere. But the exposure you get is a pretty broad world exposure. So that's one place we're looking. And the other thing from a sector perspective, I guess, is worth noting that a bit of a favourite in the Australian market is to be chasing the banks. And we saw the banks rallied very hard off their lows a couple of months ago. So they sort of hit the lows with the coronavirus, and there was all this concern about banks and the problems they're going to have from bad debts and all these homeowners who aren't paying their mortgages and just accruing the mortgages. And then around about June, that sort of alleviated, and the banks went on this big run, and they've almost given it all back now on that same view, is that in the longer term, if you're looking through a period where people generally have much higher debts, but effectively have the same income and unemployment's much higher, then the banks are going to lose out from that. And in an era of low interest rates, where the central banks are all talking about lowering the longer term interest rates curves and flattening the bond yield curve, that's detrimental to banks as well. And so that's certainly another area where we want to be avoiding.
Mm, okay, very good. All right, fantastic. Thanks very much, gentlemen. Terrific show. Plenty to come, I think, on obviously the election piece. And as you say, I think volatility is going to be a huge component of the markets going forward as well. And we're sort of seeing a little bit of that in the last few weeks and most of September. So thanks again. And also thanks for the question. A question for the audience, actually, if you're listening in and you're near our YouTube chat, is to drop in your answer to how do you think markets will respond to an election win in either direction? So feel free to drop in some questions, some answers there in the comment box, and we can have a bit of read through and continue the discourse. So on that note, we hope you've enjoyed today's show. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date with news from us, follow us on social media. We always appreciate guest or topic suggestions. So if you've got one, feel free to drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. And finally, if you know anyone who gets something out of today's episode, feel free to share with a friend, let them know about it, and help our podcast grow. So on that note, thanks very much for your attention today. Terrific show, and we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.